Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with your hosts, Drs. Francine Foss and Anish Chagpar. Dr. Foss is a professor of medicine in the section of medical oncology at the Yale Cancer Center and is an internationally recognized clinician and clinical researcher. Dr. Chagpar is associate professor of surgical oncology and director of the Breast Center at Smilo Cancer Hospital at Yale New Haven. Yale Cancer Center Answers features weekly conversations about the most recent advances in the research, diagnosis, and treatment of cancer. And if you'd like to join the conversation, you can submit questions to canceranswers@yale.edu or leave a voicemail message at 1-888-234-4YCC. This week, you'll hear a conversation about hematopathology and lymphomas with Dr. Samuel Katz. Dr. Katz is assistant professor of pathology at Yale School of Medicine. And here's Dr. Anish Chagpar.
So, Sam, tell us a little bit about what exactly is hematopathology.
Sure. So, pathologists in general are a part of the medical team. And I kind of think of them sometimes, if an analogy is in like a football game, that they're kind of like an assistant coach. If you have on one side the other team being the disease, and on the other the team being the treatment, and the assistant coach, the pathologist's job is to look at that other team, the disease team, and figure out exactly what they are and what they're going to do, and inform the coach, your primary physician, as to what is going to happen. And the way that we do that as pathologists is we look specifically at the cells that are taken out of the body of the patient, and we match it up to images that we've studied over time in order to tell exactly what type of disease there is.
And so that's what a pathologist does. And so they tell us what kind of cancer it is and how it's going to behave. And sometimes they can even tell us what treatment would work best. What is a hematopathologist?
Right. So a hematopathologist is a pathologist for heme. So heme is diseases involving the blood. And so as a hematopathologist, I look at organs that get involved by blood diseases like lymph nodes or bone marrow or spleen, and I diagnose different types of blood diseases. These can be classified broadly as like lymphomas or leukemias, lymphoma being a solid manifestation of the disease, leukemia being it's happening within the circulation, within the bloodstream.
So for our audience and for me as well, help us to understand what exactly is the difference, because we oftentimes lump them together. We talk about societies for lymphoma and leukemia. And I think that many of us may get them all confused. Like, we get the fact that it's from a blood cell and it's a white blood cell, right?
Well, not necessarily. So, yes, you can classify it broadly into lymphoma and leukemia. And I think it's reasonable to be confused about the two of them because they actually are very similar. So for one example would be what people might have heard of as CLL or chronic lymphocytic leukemia. That has another name, small lymphocytic lymphoma, right? So CLL and SLL, both leukemia and lymphoma, same disease. It's just—
So you're just trying to confuse us.
Not trying to confuse, but we're trying to say that the same disease can manifest itself in different ways.
Okay, explain.
So if we first detect it in a lymph node as a solid, then we would call it small lymphocytic lymphoma. If we first detected it necessarily within the bloodstream, then we would call it chronic lymphocytic leukemia. The underlying biology of the cell, as far as we know and how we can detect it, is the same.
So you're telling me that your diagnosis is going to be dependent on whether the doctor gives you a sample of blood or a sample of a lymph node?
In part. As the disease goes on, we see that sometimes what might come to us originally as in the blood actually winds up being in the lymph node.
And so that's how come the name of the disease process can be different even though it's the same disease process.
Absolutely.
Okay. So are all lymphomas and leukemias part of the same disease process, or are there some of them that are distinct entities? So like CLL, you just said, is also called a lymphoma, but it's also called a leukemia. But are there some leukemias that aren't lymphomas?
Sure. So I think another way in which is helpful to classify it, besides the lymphoma and leukemia as to where it is also, so there's two other ways I would think about it. One is acute and chronic, and a second is on the cell type that it came from. So for acute and chronic, you would say that if the disease is something that's kind of meandering along, taking a long time, and doesn't hit the person right away, that's more of a chronic state. If it's something that's happens and the patient gets sick right away, that would be acute. In terms of the cell types now, any cell, there's many different cells within the blood, and each one of them has a potential to become malignant. So you can have what we call myeloid cells that become malignant. And these myeloid cells have several different types. There are ones that make our red blood cells. There are ones that are our platelets that help us for clotting. There are ones that help us in fight off infections like neutrophils or monocytes. And each one of those has the potential to become malignant. And so if those become malignant, then we often get diseases like people might have heard of CML or chronic myelogenous leukemia, or acute myelogenous leukemia, AML. On the other hand, there's also diseases that involve lymphoid cells or lymphocytes, which are B cells or T cells that also help us fight infections. And in this case, you can have them again in an acute state, like an acute lymphoblastic leukemia, or you can have them more chronic, like we talked about with CLL, which falls into the lymphoma type category. Lymphomas now also can be subdivided into Hodgkin lymphomas and non-Hodgkin lymphomas, and then even further subdivided beyond that.
Wow. So as a pathologist, you're looking at these different cells and trying to classify them to tell the treating physician what kind of lymphoma or leukemia it is. But do you rely in part on information that the treating physician gives you in order to figure out whether this is acute or chronic? Or is that something that you figure out under the microscope?
No, absolutely. So there's somewhat of a differing of opinions among pathologists of how they like to do it. But I think most people will start by trying to look just under the microscope to see what it is that it looks like and most resembles without being corrupted by any other part of the picture. And from that, you can get into sort of a narrow window of a differential of different possibilities. From there, then, most pathologists will go to the chart and talk with the clinician and read up on everything that's happened to the patient and say, okay, based on that information, plus the information I have from the microscope, we can put together the full story in this manner.
That's cool. So as a pathologist, how does cancer cells look different from non-cancer cells? I mean, it seems to me that you could look at blood and blood looks like blood. But so are there things that you look for that tell you, aha, this is looking like it's a cancer cell, and or maybe this is how it got to be a cancer cell?
Sure. So, you know, a lot of people like to talk about using genes and genetics to find the mutations. And now people can look at thousands of genes at the same time. Well, when you're looking at a cell under the microscope and you're looking at its morphology, you're looking at the product of all of its genes at once. And so each mutation will add up in such a way as to give a certain look to different types of cells. And so you look specifically at the cell itself, and you look to see maybe its nucleus is very large. Maybe it has a very big, what we call nucleolus, a structure within the nucleus. Maybe there is the chromatin, that is the DNA within the nucleus, looks a little bit more open. So these descriptors that I'm giving are actually what would be described for what we call blasts, which are a particular type of cell that is a very primitive early hematopoietic cell that leads to AML, or acute myelogenous leukemia. And so seeing these types of features helps us identify that this is a very active moving cell. If the chromatin or the DNA is very open, then perhaps it's making a lot of products that are helping this cell grow and move fast.
So, Sam, I mean, for a layperson, it kind of sounds like it's a lot of pattern recognition, and that it really doesn't sound all that scientific. You're not, like, looking at special genes and using fancy equipment and X-rays and tracers. I mean, you're kind of telling me, well, I'm looking to see whether the nucleus is big or not big.
So there is a fair amount of pattern recognition in pathology, and it's a very, I'd say, artistic field. A lot of people who like to look at images come into it. But that's one side of it. And I think it's important to realize that this morphology can actually get us quite far in the diagnosis, and it was what has been used for a long time. Now, in the more recent past, new techniques have come to help aid us in our diagnosis and refine our diagnosis further. And so one of them is something called immunohistochemistry, where we use antibodies that recognize specific proteins within the cell. So what is the cell expressing? And we know that some cancers express these markers and other cancers express these other proteins. And so that can help us differentiate a little bit along the way too. And we can do that on tissue that's on glass slides, or we can even dissociate the tissue a bit and look at the individual cells by flow cytometry. We've gone further, too. We can look at the genes within the cell. So using something called cytogenetics, we can take out and look at all the chromosomes within the cells and see, are they correct? Is there any what we call translocations that are present? That is where one part of the chromosome breaks off and binds to a different chromosome. And when that happens, there are certain translocations that go with certain diseases. We can also do molecular analysis where we are looking for specific mutations. And so we can take a lot of these other more scientific, perhaps, approaches in addition to our morphological judgment and integrate them all.
How often do you use all the fancy stuff?
So for hematopathology, it's actually quite frequent. So for almost every case, we are using immunohistochemistry. And for a majority, I'd say we're using cytogenetics.
I loved your analogy at the beginning of the show where you talked about the hematopathologist as the assistant coach and the guy who looks at the field and says, I see that team. They're going to blitz right there. I just know it. Do all of these fancy tests, the antibodies that look for certain proteins that are overexpressed or molecular fingerprinting, does that help the treating physician to know what drugs to use and how to fight these cancers?
Absolutely. So I think, you know, part of our job is to be kind of a prognosticator and say, yes, they're going to blitz. They're very aggressive. And we can tell that by looking at, say, markers for proliferation. And if we see that there's a lot of proliferation that's going on, we think they're very aggressive. We could also tell it by morphology, by looking for regions of death within the cancer. And if we see a lot of death, we also know that they're fairly aggressive. Knowing which type of molecular abnormalities can be very helpful for the physician as well. So if we try to, for example, translocations, if we know, for example, like in follicular lymphoma, another type of non-Hodgkin lymphoma, has a translocation that leads to an overexpression of an anti-apoptotic protein, something that causes the cell to live, we can try to target that.
Well, we're going to talk a lot more about how we target different therapies based on what you see under the microscope and with fancy tests right after we take a short break for a medical minute. So please stay tuned to learn more information about hematopathology with my guest, Dr. Sam Katz.
It's estimated that 1 in 6 American men will develop prostate cancer in the course of his lifetime, and that nearly 200,000 men in the United States will be diagnosed this year alone. The good news is that major advances in the detection and treatment of prostate cancer have dramatically decreased the number of men who die from this disease. Screening can be performed quickly and easily in a physician's office using 2 simple tests, a physical exam and a blood test. With these screening methods, early detection and a healthy lifestyle, prostate cancer can be defeated. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers to test innovative new treatments for prostate cancer. The Da Vinci robotic surgical system is an option available for patients at Yale that uses 3-dimensional imaging to enable the surgeon to perform a prostatectomy without the need for a large incision. This has been a Medical Minute, and more information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to WNPR, Connecticut's public media source for news and ideas.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Anise Chagpar, and I'm joined today by my guest, Dr. Sam Katz. We're discussing hematopathology, and right before the break, Sam, you and I were talking about this really interesting role that pathologists play in trying to figure out what cancers are going to do, how they're going to do what they're going to do, and helping the treating physician to stop them from doing what they're going to do or to block them. So tell us a little bit more. You started to mention translocations, looking at cell death. Talk to us a bit more about how exactly you look for that and what kinds of targeted therapies or therapies in general people can use based on the information that you provide.
Sure. So let me back up a little bit just to explain a little bit about what cell death is, for example. So,
yeah. You
know, cells have in them actually a program whereby they normally can die, which is a little counterintuitive. We wouldn't think that a cell would need to undergo suicide. But actually, this program, which is conserved all the way back to simple organisms, is one that normally occurs even through development. And so in order to – it turns out that this program that's used for development is also taken advantage of by the cell in order to survive. So if you have a program that can tell cells to die, and what happens is as the cell accumulates mutations and becomes malignant, it finds ways to try to activate this program.
So in other words, when a cancer cell becomes a cancer cell, it's got a program embedded in it that says, I've got too many mutations, I gotta die.
Yes, absolutely. It has this program that recognizes all these other cues and says, it's time for me to die.
So then cancer cells must kind of ignore that program when they continue to be cancer cells.
Absolutely. They must find a way around this program. They have to mutate things that are keeping them that either help them to keep them alive or that will make them die. It's a little bit of a paradox shift when it was first discovered. Most people, when they first thought about cancers, is that it's a cell that's just proliferating really quickly. And they didn't realize there's another side to that equation. You can think of it maybe like a bathtub with water in it, with the water being the number of cells. You have a faucet, sure, that's the proliferation. You can keep adding in cells, but there's also a drain to that bathtub, right? And so if you close that drain, that's also going to cause it to overflow.
Right.
And where the realization first came was from one of these translocations. So about 30 years ago, several different groups found within human lymphomas a translocation that is two parts of two different chromosomes came together, and on one side was a region of the genome that causes high expression of whatever is past it.
Okay.
And on the other side was a protein that they called BCL2, or B-cell lymphoma 2.
Okay.
And BCL2, as it turns out, is something that prevents cell death, prevents apoptosis.
So now you've got this cell that's making a lot of stuff that's preventing it from dying.
Exactly.
And that causes cancer.
It can. And it turns out that BCL2 was the first of many proteins within the cell that regulate this battle for its fate. And you have essentially two types. Ones that, like BCL2, stop the dying, that is, they guard against it, and ones that are more like executioners, that is, they kill the cell. And these proteins interact with each other and battle it out based on the signals that they're getting until one of them will ultimately win.
So in the case of a cancer, you want the executioners to win.
Absolutely, yes. And that doesn't always happen. And the way that the cancers get around it is by either increasing the number of guardians, like BCL2, or decreasing the number of executioners.
Okay, I get it. So then how do we, as clinicians, change the balance?
So what's been really exciting is that people, after learning a lot of this biology, have figured out that there are special touch points on the protein that you can target and bind to and break up this complex and get the executioners to activate. And so we now have the first of these small molecules that are designed to bind to BCL2 family members, inhibit the guardians, and let the executioners take over.
That's really exciting. So are these small molecules being used right now in therapy, or?
Yeah, so the first few of them are being used in clinical trials for several different cancers. And you can imagine that since cell death is critical to all cancers, really what the end game is that we want these cells gone, we want them to die, that this is very broadly applicable.
Wow. So are you telling me that these small molecules might actually be the, dare I say, cure for cancer?
No, I wouldn't quite go that far. I would say that they might become a very important weapon in our arsenal against cancer. And I think, as I said, they're sort of the beginning stage because we've hit a couple of the points along the pathway. But there are many other points that we would want to be able to target. And I think that what they might do is they might help shift the balance in this pathway. And because they're only perhaps shifting this balance, they'll probably need to be combined with other forms of therapy.
Mm-hmm. Is BCL2 the only guardian, or are there other guardians too?
So there's at least five total guardians. There's BCL2, BCLXL, BCLW. Those three are targeted by the first of these compounds that have been designed. There's also BFL1 and MCL1, two other guardians, which aren't touched at all by that.
Hmm. So it seems to me that you'd then need a new compound that targets them as well, because if you have, you tame the first three guardians, but the other two can proliferate, you still haven't won the battle.
Absolutely. And there's many people who are working on trying to get small molecules that target specifically those. And not only that, but some cancers are more reliant on one of those five than another. And so what would really be great is if we were targeted so that we had a specific one for each single one of those five. So that way we could say, oh, it's turns out this time it's BCLW that's up. So let's give the anti-BCLW therapeutic.
And would you be able to know that by looking under the microscope or using those fancy tests that you were telling us about earlier?
Sure. So there's two ways that one could do it. The way that's more currently used in practice today is under the microscope by using, as I was talking about, this immunostaining, where you use antibodies to recognize what proteins are expressed. So for follicular lymphoma, which has the BCL2 translocation, we have an antibody that recognizes BCL2. and then we can see the overexpression or the expression of BCL2 in those cells. There's a second way that people are trying as well, which is something that looks at the functional activity of the pathway. And it kind of treats, it isolates out the cells, and you look to see which member of the pathway is more active by tickling it a little bit in different ways and reading out your outputs. And one of the interesting findings using this was that if you take out patients' tumors and find that they are very resistant to cell death, it turns out that correlates very well with how the patient's going to do in response to standard chemotherapy. Again, pointing to how important this pathway is, not just for the particular small molecules we use to reactivate it, but in general for even the standard chemotherapeutics we're using today.
So this might be either something that you would use in conjunction with standard chemotherapy or maybe even instead of?
Possibly. I think the first step would be in conjunction. And as we learn more about it and as we get more targeted therapies, then we would start grouping it and pairing it with those.
So, Sam, you know, when you mentioned what BCL stands for, it was B-cell lymphoma, right? And it seems to me the other one that you mentioned was MCL, which is mantle cell, right?
No. So just to be careful. So MCL is actually myeloid cell leukemia.
Okay.
Which is different from MCL or mantle cell lymphoma. They share the initials.
All right. But regardless, it seems to me that all of these really have their root in blood cancers.
So, agreed. It's definitely where the story started. And that's often the case because blood cancers are a very amenable system to work with in the laboratory compared to solid tumors.
Why is that?
Well, because we can get out the individual cells and culture them more easily within the lab. We've learned many more techniques, and most of the what we learned in blood early on then later got applied towards the solid tumors.
And so do you think that that's kind of traditionally going to be the case, that a lot of cancer research is going to start in the blood laboratories and then find its way into breast cancer and colon cancer and everything else?
Well, I think that we are informed now from both sides. There's a lot of basic work that went on very early in the blood that then got pulled into solid cancers. But then as time has evolved, lots of knowledge has been gained distinctly from solid tumors like breast cancer or colon cancer. And that then has circled back now and started to inform blood.
So let's talk a little bit about that, because so often our guests on this show talk about targeted therapies, and they talk about specific genes or specific markers in their specific cancer that's their favorite. So when we talk about breast cancers, they're talking about HER2 or estrogen receptor. When they talk about thyroid cancer, there are others. When they talk about head and neck cancers, they may talk about EGFR, and same with lung cancer. Do those markers play a role in blood cancers as well, or not really?
So for the There is an overlap, but the particular ones that you had mentioned, not necessarily so. The apoptosis ones, though, this BCL2 family, they do overlap from blood to all the other cancers as well. And they sit at a point where all, as we said, remember, these cells feel signals coming into them. Well, the way they feel these signals are through these other pathways like EGFR or HER2. They impinge upon the apoptotic cascade, telling the cell whether to live or die.
So it sounds to me like all of these pathways are really interconnected, and the more we're learning about blood cancers, the more we're learning about cancers overall.
Absolutely.
Dr. Samuel Katz is assistant professor of pathology at Yale School of Medicine. We'd like to invite you to share your questions and comments with the doctors. You can send them to canceranswers@yale.edu or leave a voicemail message at 888-234-4YCC. And as an additional resource, archived programs from 2006 through the present are available in both audio and written versions at yalecancercenter.org/answers/archives. We'd like to thank the Yale Cancer Center for providing production support as part of the Connecting Our Communities initiative from Connecticut Public Broadcasting. We'd also like to thank Renee Gaudette, Emily Fenton, and the staff of the Yale Broadcast and Media Center where the interviews are conducted. I'm Bruce Barber, hoping you'll join us again next Sunday evening for another edition of Yale Cancer Center Answers here on WNPR, Connecticut's public media source for news and ideas.